This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Friday, 12th of May, 2023. This is our first edition of the Listener's Podcast, which we will be doing every Friday. And what I do want to say, though, at the top here, we've had such an overwhelming response and so many great comments and questions in our survey, which we intended to be a weekly survey. I think we're already now going to decide to switch it to a biweekly survey so that we get more of a chance over 2 weeks to put out two Friday editions where we address some of your questions, and just to give us more time and to give your time, give your questions some of the time they deserve. So with that in note, let's dive in. This is a fun experiment to try to see if we can make it more conversational, longer form podcast, where we look at both the things we surveyed our listeners about, and as well just addressing or beginning to address some of your questions. So let's, if you have access to today's slide deck, as always, you can find the link into today's podcast description to the survey questions. The first couple were a bit on what you'd like to hear about, the first one. And I offered a few topics, and I offered people a chance for some other topics to look at. And it was quite interesting, Peter. It looks like you're the most popular person or the man in the hot chair here, because the general equity market direction, by far, the most popular response there. But there, and I was a bit surprised that it's the scale of the geopolitics beat the debt ceiling by that degree that it did. So some 20% concerned on geopolitics, and on the debt ceiling, less than half of that. And then in the free form questions, it was quite interesting to know. I put some on the next slide there. There was a pretty strong interest in hearing more about the regional bank situation, which was not one of the options there. And then I also noted some of the other responses and questions that were related to what people would like to hear about. So, Peter, since people want to hear about the general equity market direction, I suspect most of our audience have some involvement in the equity market here. We've talked a bit about in our internal meetings, we've seen this loss of momentum. We are sort of the top of the range, and at least the mega cap portion of the market, the S&P is still in the range, but still pretty much at the top of the range that's been established for quite some time as well. We're struggling here to find huge inspiration for the upside or the downside. Maybe Europe a little bit different because we've come so far, but what are your thoughts, if any, to address this most popular of questions that our listeners have?
Yeah, first of all, I want to say that I'm not that surprised. Not that it sounds weird, right, to say I'm not surprised that I'm popular, but it's not me that are popular. It's the equity. It's the equity market, right?
Always popular.
And I'm not confused, though. I think it was quite expected because Saxo has also changed a lot over the past 10 years. When I arrived 13 years ago, the equity market was not a very big part of this business, and now we have lots of clients. And in general, I would say the equity market changed. When I came in 13 years ago, people were still disappointed, frustrated, depressed, maybe even. We had just had our second 50% drawdown in the equity market. There was no excitement over equities. And then slowly, as the years progressed, it became more and more. And I think ever since we basically got to around the start of the pandemic, a lot of people are talking about equity market. And I have a little fun story before I talk a little bit more general about the equity market. So I got my tires changed the other day, and I went to this repair shop here in auto repair shop here in Denmark. While he's changing his tires, this guy comes into the outlet, and he's a taxi driver. And these two guys apparently know each other. Maybe they're a related family or whatever. They start talking. And they were talking about Danske Bank shares, and they were talking about stocks in general. And I was like, okay, this is where we've got to in terms of equities, that the local auto repair guy, he's talking about equities while he's changing my tires. That was pretty fascinating. But talking about the general equity market, I would say that if we start with a short-term view, so we've talked about it, John, on this podcast, what does it take for the equity market to go down? I was saying the single biggest thing that always impacts equities more profoundly. So we had the interest rate shock, but that's a one-off. Now we have the interest rate level stabilized, so that's not a risk any longer to the same degree. So we're now left with the always obvious one, which is a recession. And the big question is, do we get a recession or not? And it ties back, as you pointed out here, the growth outlook. I think for the time being, and I think Steen also mentioned it in our internal call that went a little bit longer this morning, that the fundamentals are where it is difficult. But if we get a recession, it's probably only going to be a shallow one, unless we get some crisis moment that sort of amplified, and then it could become a bigger thing. But I think the equity market, if you look at the pricing, is very relaxed about a recession. That's what you see in the equity valuation. We've had a tremendous amount of hype around AI. I'll actually get back to that later in the podcast when we take some of the listeners' questions. And then I just very high level, but just very quickly. So when we have an inflationary environment, equities long term tend to follow it or either on par or even exceed a little bit the inflation. So what do you buy if you buy, if you buy equities? Well, it's basically a bet on innovation, productivity, long term. So when you look at the equity market today, just for new listeners or listeners that are not familiar with equity, so when you do the return expectations for the long term, so what you do is you start with the dividend yield. That's around 2.5% in the global equity market. You look at the buyback yield, it's around 1% right now and has been stable, hovering around 1% over 5-10 years. Why is that important? Because companies, they use buybacks as a more efficient way to return capital when you're a multinational corporation. That's something we worried about 30 years, 40 years ago, but now we do. So that gives you a yield of 3.5%. And then if you take the long-term expected growth rate in real GDP around 2%, you add that, and then you have actually a 5.5% real expected return in equities from the current levels. So you can argue that I think that's actually okay when you compare that to what you're offered in many bonds. That's the long-term view and not the short-term view.
All right. And then I think actually arguably a couple of the other popular answers to that question are very interlinked. So the growth outlook is going to be very linked, of course, with what Treasury yields are doing. And we have actually some predictions on the Fed as our next question. And then I think geopolitics as well is going to have a long-term impact, of course, on growth. And actually next week, we'll do a small roundup, by the way, at the end of this call on the current market environment, a couple of developments yesterday and the week forward. So all these are, you know, to some degree are, of course, interrelated, but it was nevertheless interesting to get that level of feedback. And Ole, you had a comment.
Yeah, just a comment on bonds, because actually looking through all the answers we got, there was actually quite a few talking about what happened to Althea, our bond girl. And Althea has just recently returned. She's the proud mother of two now, and she is getting up to speed, and she will be joining the podcast on a regular basis going forward. So Althea is back, and expect some additional, more in-depth information to come on the bond market.
Yeah, we definitely look forward to having her expertise on board of the podcast again. I think it's the week after next. She may be already involved with our a couple times a week with the daily podcasts. All right, the next question, I think this is a very interesting one to address. It was an actual survey on how our listeners felt on where the Fed is headed and what the Fed's likely policy rate would be towards the end of this year. And pretty overwhelming response there, with well over 50%, pushing towards 60%, indicating they believed that the Fed policy rate will be at or slightly below the current level. And the second most common response was that it would be, and that was 20%-ish, actually above the current level, so that the economy reheat sufficiently to require that the Fed hike rates once more. And the two weaker answers, or the less popular answers, were where the market is currently pricing the Fed funds to be. And at the time of the survey a few days ago, I think it's a tad lower now, was at around 4.37%. So getting towards three Fed cuts of 25 basis points by that time frame. And then below 4% was the final option, and that was considered very unlikely. So I have some thoughts on that myself. I think, actually, ironically, the market expectations and the cuts, where we're going to be in December and whether we're going to be at 4.375% is, I think, will be, if we are at that level at some point in time out in the future, we'll be at that level for an extremely short period of time. Because I think it's likely that, as most of our users indicate, that it's going to be at or slightly below current levels for as long as the Fed can stand to keep it there. Looking at the inflation equation, if the labor market data starts to deteriorate badly, we saw an interesting claims number yesterday, by the way, and if, especially if we get into some sort of crisis mode, as we've discussed, which is basically the only thing we can see triggering the sort of Fed forward view that the market has, then I think the Fed cuts will come fast and they'll come furious, and we're talking about 100 basis points all at once, for example, the first time they cut as a possibility. So I think it'll either be at or near current levels, or it'll be below 4%. Would be my way of answering that question. And I just roll forward to the next slide there on slide F5. You can see how the market is pricing this. I mean, there's a huge. Those are the different SOFR contracts, by the way, which is a 3-month interest rate future for the U.S. From the next one, or at least the one in September, which is around the time of the anticipated first Fed cut, through to early 2025. And you can see the 200 plus basis points of easing that is priced in there. And keep in mind, when we talk about what the market is expecting in terms of this forward curve, the SOFR contracts is one of the world's deepest markets, you know, billions of P&L for every tick up and down. It's a liquid market that allows people to hedge. So you could think of the forward curve as a sort of probability matrix and a reflection of where people are hedged as much as some sort of abstract expression of the market's view on where rates are headed. So, of course, it has its own information value. It does contain some kind of expectations, directionality, but just a really remarkable forward curve priced in there. And again, I suspect we're either well below 4% because we've hit some crisis, we've hit some bump in the road, or we haven't changed much. I don't see why the Fed starts dribbling in rate cuts. It's you know, you get to a point where the recession seems to be looming suddenly, the labor market is deteriorating quickly, and they start cutting by 50s and maybe even 100 since we've come up as far as we have. Peter.
Yeah, I think this whole question about, you know, the Fed pricing, it ultimately comes back to where structural inflation is in the U.S. economy, but also here in Europe. And I saw this wonderful slide. There was someone that put up a slide. I think I read it on Twitter, where they put five pretty notable people. I think with the CIO of Bridgewater. I can't remember whether it was Ray Dalio, the chief economist from the World Bank, the chief economist from IMF, and then two economists from two pretty big banks. Not mentioning any names here. And that those comments that they pulled out was from, you know, the second half of 2021. And they all talked about, we are in a structurally low inflationary environment. So they were still speaking into this, you know, it was transitory. And I think it really tells you a lot about the world we're living in. So you have people arguably very, very connected into the system. Some would even argue, well, great investment record, Bridgewater. We should put a lot of weight on their views on the market. They were totally wrong on inflation, right? And we have a market that is still, I mean, I would argue, John, that this Fed forward curve pricing here is an echo from the past. It's still the market ultimately believing that we are in a low inflationary environment. And this is a completely personal opinion. To me, it doesn't square very well with the fragmentation game. And that actually goes back to that, you know, people want us to talk about geopolitics. I think we live in probably the most fascinating time period since maybe just the years before the end of the Soviet Union. We were hibernating almost like, you know, in this fairy tale. What was the
Sleeping Beauty? Or?
Yeah, Sleeping Beauty, right? Yeah. We had this wonderful period with this marriage. I always go around talking about we were in this happy marriage with the US and the recycling of dollars. Russia was providing the energy and metals. China had, you know, compressed inflation with the world's factory. It was so good, right? And now everything is just fragmenting. And to me, all roads will lead to a structurally higher inflation level. And it was interesting. So we have Richard Mund, which is a Swiss-based luxury maker. They reported earnings this morning. And one of the key bits that came out of the earnings call was that the CEO, and I don't know how much weight you should put on a luxury maker CEO, but he said, I think people are underestimating how sticky inflation is going to be. Interesting comment, I think. Because I agree.
Yeah, well, Ole, in your space, that's providing perhaps one of the biggest drags on the potential for forward inflation to pick up, because we've seen some pretty sideways to even lower markets in places, as we'll talk about later, copper even breaking down. So what are we waiting for for commodities to wake up?
Well, I think the market is simply waiting for, in the short term at least, just to get more clarity on the economic, the direction of the economic outlook for some of the major economies. We are pricing in recession at this point. We're seeing quite a big discrepancy between where the oil price is trading and where an organization like OPEC, where they see demand this year. We got the IEA next week as well, coming out with their expectations, and something clearly doesn't square up there, because the prices, if that demand is going to be there, then prices will be higher. But if we are heading into a higher inflationary environment than we've seen in the past, which I agree with as well, then the commodity sector is obviously a sector that will attract some attention. We're going through a rough period here, but I think we're mean reverting some of the strong gains we had last year. But ultimately, we have to keep an eye on the supply and availability of supply in the coming years, and several areas are still experiencing tightness and increased tightness. We just had a report this morning from Thailand. They are asking farmers to just reduce their rice crop to one instead of the usual two because they got a very strong heat wave across Southeast Asia right now. Something like that is again just we're having a very good time right now in terms of food prices coming down. Unfortunately, not in the supermarkets, but at least in the futures market, it has come down quite dramatically. But we are never more than a very heat burst away from that to reverse. And then we have the whole the industrial metal outlook with the green transformation and so on. What we're seeing right now in copper, the breakdown yesterday, we're seeing that as temporary. So inflation for longer is underpinning commodities, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I think it's fascinating because when you said this word that commodities almost pricing in a recession, right? And I just said equities are not worried about a recession. So how do you connect the two dots, right?
Because so who's the clever one in the room?
Yeah,
in
exactly.
And I always stress the bond market.
Yeah, exactly. That's the notion you always get from a macro guy like John. Is like the equity guys are the stupidest people in the room, right? And maybe they are this time around. It's just fascinating that there is this disconnect. Also, the Fed forward. I mean, I think a lot of the Fed funds, the SOFR forward curve, what is being expressed in equities, what is being expressed in commodities, it's not adding up to completely to me. So something has to give. And one of the things, when I was looking at the commodity market, when you go back to the 1970s, it was a very structurally long period for commodities and inflation, and you actually had a similar drawdown in the commodities spot index from Bloomberg, around 25%. I'm trying to convince myself, or I've been thinking that maybe this just is just normal, that when you have had such an acceleration in commodity prices, there is just there's a pushback against that and a recalibration of prices before, you know, maybe the next leg.
Because in theory, really, the commodity space is the old saying: the best cure for high prices is a high price, because it incentivizes additional production and it lowers demand. And perhaps that's part of that we're seeing unfolding right now.
Yeah, let's roll forward to the third question. We had four. The fourth one was basically ask us anything or say anything. We're hoping to get a few questions there, and over half answered with some questions, and that's one of the reasons I think we're going to make this a bi-weekly survey, so we have a chance to address more of those. But the third question was, we've had a lot of debate about, you know, oh, we need to be more disciplined, we need to make a 15-minute podcast on our daily podcast, and how long should it be? So just to alleviate that level of concern or get a sense of it, we asked, you know, what do you think about the length of the podcast? And the options were, unfortunately, I didn't only ask that, and it opened up for some further comment, but that was also fortunate because we got some different views on our intention to do this new setup with the Friday Listener Podcast and then possibly a longer one on Wednesday. So anyway, very small minority thought it was thought the podcast should be shorter. So thank you very much for that, because that at least allows us to consider ourselves excellent entertainers and talk as long as we want. Some wanted it longer, more than twice as many wanted it longer, but still only about 15%. And then it was just interesting in the free comment area that some 29% we tallied it up said, look, it's good as it is, don't worry about the time. And there were some various versions of that. And then it was very interesting to see as well, the very strong yellow bar. Maybe it's, you know, these questions can sometimes be leading. Survey making is a science, but we just added the option, you know, we'd like to see us go into more detail on special topics, and that was very popular with pushing 50% of respondees. So, and that, you know, hopefully we'll be satisfying that with some of the Friday podcasts, and especially the longer Wednesday one, and maybe even smaller segments where we do some miniature drill downs in the daily podcast. But we got lots of useful feedback on that question.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole going on in more detail about things, I'm looking forward to the Wednesday helicopter perspective. Also because we had some listeners saying that they wanted us to be a little bit more strategic as we were in the past. Maybe we got too much into the daily run and mill of just, you know, commenting on the ebb and flow of the market. And I can definitely relate to that. I think both things are important, just to get, you know, always a temperature on what the market is, the vibes, what we're seeing, because that is exactly what we're trying to provide to our listeners, is that we are combined a filter that is filtering all the information based on our experience, and then we're trying to you know, make it very accessible for a lot of people. But going into detail could also be on equities, and maybe people can write that in the next survey. That, I mean, could also be a company, right?
Sure.
I could go on the podcast and we could talk in more detail. Okay, let's talk about NVIDIA. Let's talk about ASML.
We could also do it. And I might challenge you on this. In the future, we could also do, okay, Peter, how do you approach looking at a company?
Yeah,
exactly. Based on a publicly accessible website, financial information, and or Saxo, what Saxo clients can offer. So without having to have a extensive look into the financials. All right, and then on Q4, it was just like basically an ask us anything. I think one of the future questions, tongue in cheek, maybe any ideas for Saxo Market Call meme shirts. We had one suggestion there. I don't know if you want to talk about that one, Ola. But just some great questions. And again, the reason we're going to stretch this over a couple of weeks so we can round up at least a reasonable percentage of the many responses that we got. And I guess maybe before I hand over to you guys have highlighted a couple that you wanted to pull out, and I'll wrap up or I'll address a couple. But there was a Danish listener that challenged me to say one of the more difficult to say Danish, I guess it's a dish you make here in Denmark, thinking that, American, he can't speak Danish. And I don't speak Danish very well in terms of correct Danish, but I can speak Danish, and I don't have a horrible American accent. So I will say it's a Danish dessert called sort of red... How would you translate that? Red pudding with cream. So it's basically something like rødgrød med fløde, which is an approximation of how it sounds in Danish. So there you go. I hope that had some entertainment value. But what's the first couple of questions? I'll leave it to one of you to jump in that you wanted to pull out from our Q4 there. Question four.
I think there's a few more that could be answered very quickly, and I think it's a good idea to try to translate as many as we can. So where is the podcast recorded? Well, we have this lovely studio in the headquarter. Saxo's headquarters is in Copenhagen. Copenhagen is in Denmark, which is in Europe. So that's a very tiny little landmass there in the on this planet. So
If you're familiar with Danish beers, Tuborg beer used to be made basically
exactly here.
Next door to where we shoot this. It's a Tuborg Harbor, in fact, is the name of the very local part of Copenhagen.
Yeah, and the very quick funny story is that it was the son that was frustrated about his dad, because the dad was not a very nice guy, the one that created Carlsberg. So he created the competing brand, Tuborg, and it was placed here, far away from Carlsberg, far away from his dad. Became a big success.
And tastes better.
Some would argue. Why is Druk important in your opinion? I think you highlighted it in a previous podcast, John. I think it's very rare. I always like to listen to Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett. And if you're a macro, if you really like macro, Druckenmiller is definitely one of the ones you want to listen to. Others really like Ray Dalio. And I think it's more about, it's very rare you meet people who have been in the industry for 40 years, 45 years, and seen a lot of cycles. It does add more weight to what they are saying, because they have just a better reference, I think, for commenting on what's going on in the world. Wouldn't you agree, or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, asking why is Stanley Druckenmiller important? I mean, the guy was George Soros's chief trader. He was the one that came up with the trade idea of challenging the Bank of England as it was being threatened to be kicked out of the or trying to maintain its relationship with the ERM. And it was Soros that said, "This is a great idea. You just need to make sure you supersize it. Don't go in cautious. Go in all guns blazing." He's also very humble, so he's happy to admit, and just as a good educational, exercise, listening to how he is humble about his past and will admit, I could be wrong at any time. He is very happy to talk about how badly he got 1999 when he got in the very last minutes into early 2000, couldn't bear how much money people were making in the tech stocks, finally capitulated after not being in these things and went all in, he said, within hours of the top. But then later that year got so aggressive in shorting them that he actually more than made up for the losses. So just always a voice worth listening to. And by the way, he's calling for a recession starting as early as now, basically, based on evidence in retail sales that he's hearing, anecdotal, he says a lot of it, but as well on the tightening of credit and that whole situation that was kicked off starting in March. But yeah, these big voices that, some people, although I will say, some of the people that I've listened to in the past that have been very accurate, and this is not to say anything about Druckenmiller, but at this cycle have proven disastrously wrong. So everybody seems to have their sweet spot. The deflationists were coming into 2022 saying the Fed is not even going to be able to hike once the first time. And they constantly called that it would actually be soon the end of the Fed's hiking cycle. So you should always listen to a variety of voices, and whether it's Druckenmiller or anybody else, not just one voice. But over to you guys for any thoughts or any questions you want to pull out.
Well, on the commodity space, I'm obviously very happy to see that a lot of people are interested in that sector as well, and also someone asking a bit more of a deep dive into the sector. That's something we most certainly will look at. I have one is talking about the contango backwardation, how that impacts the markets, and it's a very relevant question. And I think we just I'll probably work on some kind of a daily update that we can put into the appendix on our daily podcast slide deck, just to give you some thoughts about changes, because obviously it's contango and backwardation, and basically the shape of the forward curve in commodities is really telling very, very interesting stories, because the spot market can be, well, not manipulated, but it can be. There can be a lot of activity in the spot market, which may not necessarily have anything to do with fundamentals. But the curve is telling you a story about ample supply or tightness in the market, and how that impacts prices going forward. So that's something I'll dig into. So thank you for that comment.
All right.
Yeah, and then actually I'll pull one out myself, and it's so big a topic that we're going to have to talk about it as it approaches. But the U.S. default, if it happens in the U.S. dollar. I just think I need to, you know, double, triple, and quadruple underline this default just cannot happen. They will have to go to absolutely extreme measures to ensure that the default does not happen. They'll have to cut people's pay. They'll have to do whatever they can to prevent this happening. It's an absolute disaster if it does happen. I'm assuming it won't, but of course I'm going to monitor to the degree I can all the levels of risk. And you can have plenty of risk in terms of what could happen to the economy if you suddenly start cutting people's social security checks and start cutting federal employees' pay. This can multiply very quickly into a confidence crisis and suddenly accelerate a recession scenario. So that's just important. It's obviously a very important issue to track. And even without a quote-unquote default or technical default, could still have the standoff, game of chicken and the big standoff over it, could still have a very deep impact.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that I think, you know, it's a highly political discussion in the U.S. right now. But if we look at the facts, the deficit right now is 8% of nominal GDP. The structural deficit long-term have been around 3% of nominal GDP. So you could actually argue that, you know, there is a case to be made why the U.S. government should rein in their spending. Mm. The question is just how much and where. I was looking at the numbers, and if you take the deficit down to 4%, then it would actually account to a 3.7 percentage point negative impulse into GDP growth from that alone. If you did that, and then you can always question, can we smooth it out over a longer period? And then I mean, but then we have a presidential election coming up next year. It's just, I don't know where this is going to end, but I think there is a case for why the U.S. government, because why would you run 8% deficit when you have the tightest labor market in decades and galloping inflation? So
yeah. It is crazy, and you're right. It does need to be addressed. But at the same time, the dollar is the world's reserve currency. Mm-hmm. So there's no logical connection between what the dollar does and the risk of a default necessarily. Yes, back in 2011, when U.S. debt was marked lower, the dollar is basically about to hit a low. But there's tens of trillions of dollars of U.S. dollar-denominated debt that has to be constantly rolled, and people are constantly needing dollars. They need to have collateral that's a risk-free dollar, you know, treasuries. And these are not getting produced to the same degree when you have a treasury that can't issue. So when it does need to rebuild its account, that's going to pinch dollar liquidity. So I think actually the beyond the point of the presumed solution to a deal that lifts the ceiling, you're going to have the treasury needing to, you know, build back up by hundreds of billions of dollars, and that's going to be pressure on the liquidity, unless we're in a recession scenario and the Fed is providing the offsetting easing. There's been a lot of talk about the fact that the Fed's quantitative tightening has been overcompensated by what the Treasury has been doing. So we haven't really seen the quantitative tightening impacting of late.
Yeah, the very strong dollar and the discussion about de-dollarization, John, I think it's a very deep topic. I would love to actually engage in that topic on a Helicopter Wednesday podcast, because I think it's about the fragmentation game and what's happening right now with the very strong dollar. It's so penalizing for many emerging market countries. Remember back in the days when you had gold, governments were frustrated because it really constrained you when you went into war, right? That's why we wanted the fiat currencies, because it allows you a great amount of flexibility, but also it comes with a risk of creating inflationary periods that are awful and can actually cripple society. And you see Lula, the president of Brazil, traveling to Beijing, and then he says, you know, why do we need to trade on the dollar? And you know, the rising dollar, strong dollar, is really hurting emerging markets, especially because they're accessing credit markets through the euro dollar market, so they issue a lot of debt in dollars. So when the dollar is strong and the dollar interest rate is also going up, it's a double whammy also, because a lot of the revenue is generated in the local economy. So there is a case to be made that we need a new system, and you have been arguing for that for years, as I've known you, John. And this multipolar world that we are moving into, it does really feel like that we have this clash between two value systems. We have a clash in the economic system. China wants to make their currency the second sort of, what can you say, currency subscription you can subscribe to. And a lot of countries want to do that, I think.
And incompatibly want to maintain capital control. So it has to be some kind of currency that they control that can be used as a central bank reserve asset outside of their country if they want to be successful in having some, I don't know, digital offshore UN or what have you. But that's the tension in terms of the actual use of renminbi or the Chinese yuan to act as a reserve currency. And you need to run massive deficits. That's what the U.S. has been so good at, providing that dollar as an asset, as a fungible currency for the world by running massive deficits, as part and parcel of having your currency being used as the global reserve currency.
Yeah, a couple of more questions, and then we of course need to wrap this podcast. But I wondered, because Ole is standing next to me and he was tripping, and there's a link into the gold, and we're warming up for a bigger focus on gold in our next quarterly outlook, because it's, as you said, John, this morning, I think it was, I hadn't really thought about it, but how do you express this de-dollarization and fragmentation game? And you said something that I hadn't been thinking about, that it's actually quite difficult to do it in fiat currencies, and maybe gold is the ultimate expression for that transition period that we are in before we get to something else. Because I agree with you, the Chinese currency not being a free-floating currency is a difficulty in making it the second choice for other countries, including Brazil. Because then if it's all on capital control, then ultimately you're controlled by the Chinese government. And is that the flexibility you want? I don't see that either, right?
Two things, and I'll throw it over to you, Ole. First of all, apropos Druckenmiller, that's one of his key concerns, is the debt dynamic situation in the U.S., where we're, you know, such a high percentage of the government tax revenues are going exclusively to distribution payments for Medicare and Social Security. He says, look, you can talk all you want about politics, but there is an absolute certainty that in real value, you have to cut social care and you have to cut the medical system, or you have to raise taxes. And the amount that taxes would have to be raised to fund these deficits is staggering in the U.S. relative to much more modest levels of deficits, for example, in Europe. So he makes that dollar negative part of his argument there. But you're right. So other economies are just as indebted as the U.S. The U.S. happens to be very indebted on the public side. On the private side, it looks actually pretty solid compared to an Australia or a Canada, where it looks very egregious. And I suspect that whatever the next big recession we're heading into is going to see a lot of that debt ending up on the public balance sheet. Europe is somewhat of a mix. But there's also the argument, Ole, and I've seen this argued by some clever people that I listen to, at least, that the gold market kind of gets fiatized anyway. You can say, well, there's this paper gold out there, and it's really the physical gold is what we need to concentrate on. But physical gold prices are also affected by, there's very, very large amounts of paper trading in gold. So it's hard to separate out the hard asset from the all the derivatives and paper structure around the trading of gold.
Absolutely. And that's throughout the decades, always, or at least the past few decades, always generated questions about the ability to for the market to be manipulated. I think overall they go hand in hand. One needs the other, because the liquidity in the gold market for trading is provided in the so-called paper market, and ultimately it is for all commodities, it's always ultimately the underlying availability and supply and demand that will dictate the price. And what we are seeing and have been seeing for a while now is central banks hoovering up gold at a record pace, and part of that is the de-dollarization story. And I think if we are entering into a period here where we will eventually see peak rates in the U.S., we will see a drop. If we do see a recession, and potentially, as John mentioned, the the rapid succession of rate cuts into a weak economy, that will be an additional support for gold, and one that we have been looking for. And in addition to that, also the long-term inflation outlook, which where we simply believe the market is wrong in believing that we'll get back to sub 2.5% in the long run. So that basically means that, and we talked about that as well internally ahead of that, our Q outlook, that the downside risk in gold perhaps at this point is what, 15-20%, but the upside could be 100. So our view is skewed to the upside. We're going through a bit of a correction right now, and that, maybe that just takes us into just a brief talk about today's markets. I put in just a slide on copper and silver, because we did see a tumble in copper yesterday, and again that's also a move that we don't think is justified from the medium to long term perspective. But again, this is a flow driven market, so we did see a technical break below 380, and that triggered some additional long liquidation, and the market is now trying to recover from that. At the same time, that dragged silver down. We were down 5% yesterday, but just look at the chart, you can see that the correction following that 31% rally between March and May is relatively shallow so far. So it's not as if the uptrend has been broken by that big move down. Silver is just doing what silver does best. It takes the stairs up and the elevator down, but we're looking for support to emerge fairly soon there.
Yeah, so Dr. Copper indicating, just like the forward Fed expectations, that something is about to go awry in this global economy. Interesting there. On the FX space, I don't want to go through too much, but it was interesting to see the Bank of England meeting yesterday where they marked their terminal rate a little bit higher to 4.75%, so that would require another 25 basis point hike. They tried to guide for a little bit more uncertainty around their 1% inflation forecast for the next 2 to 3 years. I'd be very surprised if they get anywhere near that, of course. And the market tried to take it initially as a little bit hawkish, and we had already seen a very strong sterling coming into this meeting. My bias was that this would be a sell-the-fact moment for sterling, and that's indeed what happened, as UK rates at the front end of the curve came down quite sharply. And if you look at the cable chart there I put up on slide 7, you can see that we've come back down. We need another full figure or more of downside to start to reverse out that attempt above the former 124.50 peak there. And then just I find it remarkable that the yen just can't seem to sustain a proper bid. Yes, it got bid yesterday on U.S. yields dropping. Key to note, that jobless claims figure in the U.S. popping way above 250K for the first time in over 18 months. So we need to track that one. If that moving average starts coming up aggressively, that is one of the slightly leading indicators relative to the slower monthly data that we'll need to track. And the PPI was slightly softer as well. But interesting to see that, despite U.S. yields lower, the U.S. dollar was bid, and that the yen just couldn't really sustain that broader bid all that well. It didn't really weaken again that much so, if you look at the Eurians and Sterlingians, et cetera, but it's still a disappointment there. Supposed to be supportive of the yen when you get these yield drops. And then I think the week ahead, we'll need some discussion, but I'll do that on the wrap there, Peter. Was there any comment you wanted to make on today's or the sort of the short-term stuff before we wrap it out?
Yeah, we talked a lot about that. There was very little energy in the S&P 500, very little implied volatility to be seen in the VIX index. It's still below 17. There's a trade in Europe. Europe is seems to be very hot still. As I've been saying during the earnings season, the European companies doing better than the US companies right now. I think the European equity market is better set up for this physical world comeback and all the enormous investments that we need to do in the physical world. But yesterday there was a little bit of price action. The rally in technology stocks, the NASDAQ 100 continuous future continued higher, making new highs in the close yesterday. We're banging into those local highs we got back in Q3 of last year, when we had a small rebound during that awful, awful decline we had. And some of the positive excitement yesterday was Alphabet with its subsidiary Google announcing a lot of different plans. They're coming out with a foldable smartphone. They're going after Samsung. That's very interesting, I think. And they came out with a lot of updates to their AI technology and where they're going to implement it. And the market came away very, very excited. So that stock, the Google stock or Alphabet stock, extended by 4%. And it is quite interesting. We need to do an helicopter Wednesday podcast, John.
Don't plan too many weeks ahead now.
No, I know. But we need to do something as well on the AI. I feel so mixed about this. So on the one hand, We did the two podcasts. I feel very excited on many ways. But there was also this contrarian inside me that, oh, I've seen this before, right?
Yeah, there's so much noise.
Yeah,
I mean,
you go back 7 years, and we all thought that we would have 10, 20 million robot cars because Elon Musk was selling this dream, and we have almost none, right? There is a contrarian inside me that is saying, okay, this is an exciting technology, but we're again, over extrapolating too much. And maybe we'll have our hopes and excitement crushed, but that this is a long-term trend, but there will be more hiccups and roadblocks on the way. I think right now we're pricing that this will just be one smooth drive for AI. And I don't think that's going to be the case, actually.
Yeah, scroll back to our special edition podcast, by the way, on AI. We had a great guest, Emir Sao of
Droids Agency.
Droids Agency, who was enlightening us and made some interesting, very interesting points also on this. You could have some smaller players that could get a really good data set and optimize that. I saw an article emphasizing that point as well. It's not necessarily the biggest players that are going to take the whole cake here. All right, I want to point out in the macro calendar, not so much anything happening today. We get the preliminary May University of Michigan sentiment, always interesting. But next week, we have that G7 meeting in Japan. This could be one for the ages, and you're seeing some news popping up in the press on what this meeting could hold. There are a couple of headlines you see, things like planning on actually specifically criticizing China for quote-unquote economic coercion. Some have called this debt diplomacy, so getting active in other nations with lots of lending into the nation, and then the country can't afford to pay it back. And then, of course, involves some of the assets being transferred to Chinese ownership. But as well, a more specific one I came across this morning talking about the G7 finance ministers trying to agree on some kind of supply chain framework or agreement that you could only join if you maintained minimum standards on human rights and the environments. And then the U.S. is taking the more hawkish view in its ongoing rivalry with China and trying to drum up support for more restrictions on investment. So you could even see the U.S. going it alone with, on top of this, some sort of restriction on investments.
This is one of my really deeper theories for the longer term. I'm absolutely sure that the climate change will be used and amplified by governments in Europe and the U.S. to change and drive their industrial and trade policy going forward, because you see the weakness in the German industry right now. China is becoming a fierce competitor. On the one hand, Europe wants to have a slightly more neutral stance on China than the U.S. I think the interconnectedness is deeper there between Europe and China. But the playing the climate change card is a way of pushing the relative competitiveness in favor of you again, because you could argue, well, China, you can only compete because you're using a lot of coal power, so you have cheap energy. You do all these things that makes your input cost extremely low, and as long as we don't have a carbon border tax in Europe, then that's unfair. So I'm absolutely convinced that they will use this as a playbook to set up their trade policy.
Great point. And then, more specifically and more immediately, this weekend we have an election in Turkey, a very interesting election. There's the idea that there's not an axis, but there's a network of these more authoritarian leaning countries. Is Turkey tilting towards that way? Some would argue they are, and that another Erdogan term could see an even further tilt in that direction. At least his main opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, if I say that approximately correctly, is positioning this as a sort of a referendum on, quote, true democracy, unquote. He's accusing Russian influence peddling in the election. Some have argued that Russia is helping to prop up Turkey's finances to keep something more disorderly from developing there. Erdogan is quite desperate. He is behind in the polls by a few percentage points. Those are all over the place, though, by the way. That's an average. And he's been handing out big wage increases to public servants, part of that just to keep up with, to some degree, with inflation. But a very big, especially for the region, a very big election to watch this weekend. So stay tuned. That is up on Sunday, and we'll have a wrap on Monday on that, as well as further anticipation and talk of the debt ceiling. There's not going to be a meeting today that was intended for the U.S., for the Biden administration and House Speaker and other stakeholders. That's been put off, so that issue continues to burn on. But in any case, we hope you found this first edition of our Saxo Market Call Listeners Podcast a good one. We'll, of course, fine-tune the concept, and we'll round up some more of your questions next week with next Friday's second edition of this, and then we'll put out a new survey for the following week. For now, Have a great weekend when you get there, and we'll be back next week with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.